This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, the singer R. Kelly faces some serious legal trouble, but that didn't stop him from a nightclub appearance in Springfield last week. We'll talk with a reporter who's been following the R&B star for a decade. A lot of recommendations to save money in education involve consolidating school districts, so why doesn't it happen more often? We'll take a closer look. The country is divided these days, and Illinois is no exception. Some downstate lawmakers have an idea to split off Chicago from the rest of Illinois.
Chicago's a great international city. They compete against New York, LA, San Francisco. My district is all are part of 9 rural counties, and we are competing against Missouri and other rural areas. I think we need to have similar policies to those states in order to be able to compete economically.
That and more on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, an update on efforts to get more schools to consolidate. It could be a money saver, but it's not always popular. The singer R. Kelly is in the news for the wrong reasons. He even made a brief appearance at Springfield at a nightclub in the past week. We'll get an update on his legal troubles and why some fans still stand behind him. And we'll do some library myth-busting. That and more this hour on Statewide. When you look at the overall vote totals in Illinois, we're classified as a blue state. We're a state that leans more to the left than most, if not all, of our neighbors. And yet, dive a little deeper into voting patterns, and you'll see outside of the Chicago area, Illinois trends more conservative. J.B. Pritzker easily defeated Bruce Rauner in last year's governor's election. Still, Pritzker won only 15 of Illinois' 102 counties, and only 8 of those were outside of the Chicago area. That political divide shows up at the State House, where upstate and downstate lawmakers often clash over policies. So is it that surprising that a group of Republican legislators from the central and southern parts of Illinois have put forth a resolution calling for the state to be split in two? Chicago could be its own state, the rest of Illinois could be another. That extreme idea is unlikely to even get called for a hearing, but it hasn't stopped some from getting behind the effort. One of those is Representative C.D. Davidsmeyer of Jacksonville, and he's now a co-sponsor. But even he isn't really pushing for a state split. I talked with him about what he wants to see happen. The resolution, let me read it, it urges the U.S. Congress to take action to declare the city of Chicago the 51st state of the United States of America and separate it from the rest of Illinois. So I guess my question would be, is this a serious proposal?
I would say, for me, it's trying to make a point and start discussion. I don't think there's any chance that the General Assembly would pass this resolution. And honestly, I don't believe that they would ever let it see the light of day to begin with. But we have to have a conversation. Right now, we have two Illinois. We have basically the Chicago area and downstate Illinois. Some of these policies that may not affect Chicago's ability to compete. I mean, Chicago's a great international city. They compete against New York, LA, San Francisco, all the major metropolitan areas. My district is all are part of 9 rural counties, and we are competing against Missouri and other rural areas. And for the betterment of the economy of the entire state, I think we need to have similar policies to those states in order to be able to compete economically.
Can you give me an example, maybe one or two policies that you think Illinois should adopt that would help in the downstate economy?
Well, first off, I would say the $15 minimum wage that just passed. That was a campaign promise by the governor, and he was not willing to move off of the $15 number. Is $15 magical? I don't believe so. But, you know, we even proposed, what about, you know, $15 in the city, $13 in the collar counties, and $11 in the rest of the state? And the answer was no. It wasn't a discussion. It was no.
When Donald Trump was elected, it seems that caught some people off guard because maybe the media wasn't telling a story, or maybe many politicians weren't listening to rural areas. those regions mm-hmm. that were, you know, maybe more economically depressed. Do you think that's happening here in Illinois, that just there's a huge segment of the population, the downstate population especially, that's not being heard?
Yeah, I do believe that. I think we feel like we're being tugged around by the city of Chicago. And, you know, they pass a number of bills that they say only in cities of, you know, a million or more, or counties of a million or more, which generally has been Cook County until recently. DuPage surpassed that, I believe. But there's a number of policies that we can do the same thing with and have a little bit of a different policy for rural Illinois than we have for urban city of Chicago.
So the minimum wage that you mentioned, there was at least some idea out there at one point of having a different wage for, you know, southern Illinois, central, western Illinois, than there was in Chicago or the suburbs. You would have liked to have seen something like that compromise worked out.
Yeah, and that would have been better. At the end of the day, sometimes that, you know, my concern on that minimum wage was, you know, obviously while you're bringing people up, everyone else is not getting an 80% raise. So, you know, they're basically they're going to be pulled closer to the minimum wage, which I didn't think helped overall. But we have to be willing to compromise. We have to understand that Illinois is a very diverse state. And the answer to, you know, I've got poverty in my district, but the answer in rural Illinois is not building a community center like it may be in Chicago. You know, here, you know, you can't build a community center in the middle of nine counties and expect people who need help to be able to get there. So the answers just have to be different.
We're talking with Representative C.D. Davidsmeyer, a Republican from Jacksonville, about a state proposal that's been filed to separate Chicago from the rest of Illinois. You have to admit that Chicago is an economic engine for the state, and I've heard people when this has come up before saying that, you know, without Chicago, Illinois would be more like an Iowa or an Alabama or someplace like that. There's just not enough economic activity without the city being involved in this. Would you agree with that?
You know, I would say, you know, what's wrong with an Iowa? At the end of the day, you know, people are making the argument that the state of Illinois couldn't survive without Chicago. And I'm not saying it should try. I am saying that it can. Those states are operating in the black. The state of Illinois is operating in the red because they continue to make more and more promises and underfund the promises they've already made. So at the end of the day, would we have the most lavish government giveaways? No, we would not. But we could operate in the black.
Earlier, there was a report that came out from the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute, did a study. It's saying that downstate Illinois comes out much better than the suburbs or the city of Chicago when it comes to return on investment of tax dollars, meaning we get a lot more money back for what we put in. Do you agree with that? And do you think that,
yeah,
that if that's the case, you know, why would this be a, you know, a possible idea then?
Yeah, you know, it depends on if you're talking, you know, overall or in specific areas. I would say, in the area of education, the city of Chicago itself is a taker. But I would say, you know, probably southern Illinois is as well. Generally, the collar counties tend to be the producers for the state of Illinois. And I'm not taking away the economic engine. I believe that, you know, Chicago and the area is a place people want to be. It's a place people want to do business. And I don't want to lose Chicago. I just want to have the conversation that we have two different states here wrapped up under one policy, and we have to figure out a way to allow downstate to thrive while Chicago has their more left-leaning policies that they can, you know, compete with other cities that have those same left-wing policies.
I grew up in downstate Illinois and southern Illinois, and I can tell you that even when I grew up, there was always, you know, Chicago was looked at a little suspiciously by certain people. It was, you know, quite a distance away. We're a long state. at the same time, there was enough political power quite often downstate and in the suburbs as well that, you know, it forced compromise with the city. Do you think that because of population losses, the way things have gone in the state of Illinois, that that loss of political power in these regions has made this argument even gain more steam?
Yeah, I think that the population is moving. You know, we're losing our, manufacturing and things of that sort. Generally, you know, the majority of your manufacturing isn't downtown Chicago. It tends to be in rural areas where the workforce is there and you know, people can work at a reasonable rate and provide a reasonably nice living for their families. And we're losing that. We're not losing it to the city of Chicago. We're losing it to other states.
You said you're not really thinking this is going to happen. You're not even sure it should happen. So I guess my question would be, why sign on to a resolution? I believe you're a co-sponsor of it. Why would you do that if you're not sure that this is the right approach?
Yeah, look, you know, I would say that you would not have called me if I wasn't signed on to that that resolution. Right? My whole goal here is to have a discussion about the diversity of the state of Illinois. Like I said, Chicago is a huge economic engine. Downstate wants to be a big part of the economy of the state of Illinois. And we'd be much better off if we could have policies that differ a little bit from the city of Chicago so we can compete with those rural areas. So, you know, I think the conversation has started. Everyone that I've talked to, you know, whether for it or against it, kind of understands where I'm coming from on this and has appreciated at least having the open, honest conversation. You know, I've been in the General Assembly for 6 years, two under Governor Quinn and four under Governor Rauner. And, you know, I've seen downstate able to work with Chicago. And I think we can go back to that. I think we've got a lot of new people. This shouldn't be an adversarial thing where downstate's against Chicago and Chicago's against downstate or political parties. I think we can find a way to all work together.
That's Republican Representative C.D. Davidsmeyer. He's from Jacksonville and among a handful of lawmakers signing on to a resolution seeking to split the rest of Illinois from Chicago, creating two separate states. That measure, by the way, remains in the House Rules Committee, meaning it has not been assigned to public hearing, and that's not expected to change. You can find out more about this story, including links to the resolution and the research into how downstate residents actually fare better when it comes to their return on taxes paid to the state. That's all at statewideshow.com. The Missouri Meerschaum Company is celebrating 150 years of making corn cob pipes in the town of Washington, Missouri, west of St. Louis. The company's success after the Civil War spawned a host of competitors in Washington, making it the corn cob pipe capital of the world. Today, Missouri Meerschaum carries on the tradition alone. Mary Leonard visited the factory to bring us this story.
This is 135 years old.
Phil Morgan delights in showing visitors around the oldest corn cob pipe factory in the world. Morgan's the general manager of the Missouri Meerschaum Company in Washington. The company started making the iconic pipes 4 years after the Civil War ended. That's when founder Henry Tibby first began mass producing corn cob pipes on his lathe.
Here's a new business that starts up and flourishes and employs, for that time, a lot of people and supported the farmers in the area.
Missouri Meerschaum was the first corn cob pipe factory in Washington, and it's outlived its competitors by decades. The factory is still housed in a red brick hulk of a building sprawled along the banks of the Missouri River. Before World War II, 125 workers produced 20 million pipes a year. But Morgan says that was before tobacco companies began promoting cigarettes, and before the U.S. Surgeon General warned about the dangers of smoking. Fewer people smoke tobacco and buy pipes now. These days, the factory employs 35 people and ships about 700,000 pipes a year to customers all over the world. Morgan says pipe smokers buy corncob pipes today for the same reasons they bought them 100 years ago. They're inexpensive compared to wooden pipes, but that doesn't mean they're simple to make.
That's what people don't realize. They think you take a cob, cut it in half, drill a hole, stick something in it, and you're done. The number of processes to make a good smoking corncob pipe, there's a lot of processes and a lot of kind of artistry that's involved too.
The factory's production room is abuzz with old machinery that's still state of the art because the art hasn't changed since the 1930s. There are no robots here. Workers operate the equipment. The saw that cuts dried cobs into chunks, a drill that makes the tobacco chamber. Cobs are still coated with plaster of Paris like they were 100 years ago. That process inspired the Meerschaum name because it gives them the look of expensive pipes made from Turkish stones called meerschaums. Joshua Smith works at a lathe, carefully forming chunks of cobs into the bowls of pipes. He's 26 and has worked at the plant for 2 years.
It's just good people, and it's kind of like an art, so I like doing that. I'm an artsy guy, so.
Missouri Meerschaum embraces the past. Fiddle Music welcomes visitors to a small museum shop where they can browse through exhibits of old ledgers and photographs and see a display of pipes that were shown at the 1904 World's Fair. There's an assortment of factory-fresh corncob pipes for sale, ranging from novelty items to a series named after the outlaw Jesse James. There's also a display of authentic corncob back scratchers in red, white, and blue. Morgan says the back scratchers work.
I mean, I use them myself. However, I would definitely say you need to keep your shirt on while you're using it.
Plant manager Ordell Brown grew up in Washington and has worked at the factory for 30 years. She says Missouri Meerschaum is here to stay.
You would be surprised at how many people don't realize that we're still making as many pipes as we have been. We're planning on being here for a long time.
Morgan says the company wouldn't consider moving from its historic building, even though the space has outgrown the factory. And they'll never stop making the oversized corncob pipes that General Douglas MacArthur made famous during the Second World War. I'm Mary Leonard, St. Louis Public Radio.
If you miss any episodes of Statewide, find them at statewideshow.com. You can also find our email address there and drop us a line. We'd like to hear from you. Tell us what station you hear us on. Again, find it all at statewideshow.com. And still ahead, the lowdown on R. Kelly and an update on efforts to get more Illinois schools to consolidate. All coming up. Stay with us. Back on Statewide. It's been a difficult year for Illinois state troopers as they mourn the loss of three colleagues killed in traffic accidents while on the job. Sarah Jesmer has this report.
Enough is enough flashed on electric signs over some Illinois highways recently. That's because at least 16 state troopers have been hit on the road so far this year. The signs emphasize Scott's Law or the Move Over Law. It says drivers must slow down and switch lanes to give emergency vehicles space if they've stopped on the roadside. Three troopers have been struck and killed this year while on the road.
Officers, on Ted Hook! Illinois State Trooper, on deck! Present!
Trooper Brooke Jones' story was laid to rest in Warren, Illinois, after a funeral service in her old high school. She served in Northern Illinois. Governor J.B. Pritzker joined hundreds in mourning and spoke directly to the troopers in attendance.
You are the best of us, and Brooke was among the best of you.
Joan's story was struck by a semi while at work on the roadside. She's the second trooper killed this year after a Scots law violation. The first was Christopher Lambert in January. A third trooper was fatally hit days after Joan Story was killed, this time by a wrong-way driver. Trooper Gerald Ellis was laid to rest in Lake County. The governor attended that service, too. 66 years have passed since Illinois has seen three trooper deaths in 1 year, and it's only April. These deaths prompted new legislation to bolster Scott's law, such as House Bill 2417, sponsored by State Representative Tim Butler. The measure would turn a violation from a business offense to a petty offense, meaning no one would have to physically appear in court.
Then the other part of it was it added a misdemeanor, Class A misdemeanor, as part of the penalty if you cause bodily harm or get in a crash.
Butler says Illinois needs more troopers on the roads than they have the money for.
We need to make sure the public's educated. When you come upon a scene of someone on the side of the road, you need to slow down and you need to move over. And we need to put the resources behind to make sure people know that.
Secretary of State Jesse White responded to trooper traffic accidents with a call to action for drivers to protect those who protect us.
I think it's a violation of all laws of human decency for an individual to drive on our roads not obeying the laws that have been established.
White noted a new distracted driving law signed during the Rauner administration will mean violators face more than just a ticket.
Now, starting on July 1 of this year, individuals will get a punch on their license, which means that after three moving violations, they can lose their license.
Every state has a slow-down move-over law. For example, Texas. It has the most highways in the country. Sergeant Ryan Howard works with the Texas Department of Public Safety. He says Texan troopers campaign to bring awareness to their move-over laws through commercials, billboards, and what he calls periodic enforcement operations.
We have troopers that get together. They say, hey, you know, we want to work this area. We want to bring awareness to slow down move-over law.
Howard says multiple troopers occasionally go out on the road together. One stops a car, and the others watch to see if someone doesn't move over.
When it comes down to the actual traffic stops, now I have stopped people myself, and I have asked them why did they not move over. And they said they didn't know what to do in that instant.
Todd Barkalow is the police chief in Freeport, Illinois. He says loss of life from Scott's law violations are especially tragic because they're avoidable. He said regional law enforcement hasn't seen an increase in safer driving after these recent deaths.
Even since Trooper Story's tragic accident, they have been writing a lot of tickets and people are still not moving over and they're violating Scott's law.
Barkalow says the use of electronics have transformed the roads. He says he'd like to see community members help call out drivers who don't move over with the same urgency as calling out a burglary or a shooting.
We need the community to help us with all law enforcement.
Violating Scott's law can lead to a ticket of up to $10,000. But advocates say sometimes the consequences can be far more costly. I'm Sarah Jesmer.
You're listening to Statewide. Illinois has 852 school districts, the third highest number of any state in the nation. Some are just single schools with fewer than 100 students. But getting districts to merge or consolidate has proved difficult. Our education reporter Dusty Rhodes explains.
Last summer, Mark Ambrose became head coach of a new football team. At the first workout, he set the tone by sitting down in the middle of the floor.
If I'm a 240-pound guy, and then I had like a guy from Oblong come up, try to pick me up, who really struggled to do it, and I had another guy try to pick me up, you know, kind of with him.
Then Coach Ambrose called over a third athlete.
And all three of them could easily team up to pick me up, and I just used that as an example to say we're stronger together.
Stronger together became the team's motto, featured on t-shirts, chanted by cheerleaders, crafted into a banner by kindergartners. It was crucial, Ambrose says, because the team was a new co-op, combining students from three East Central Illinois high schools, Palestine, Hudsonville, and Oblong. The team was established just a few months after two of those towns, Palestine and Hudsonville, attempted to carry their merger beyond sports by asking voters to approve consolidation of their school districts.
The first time I visited Palestine, I remember seeing a billboard that was specifically saying to vote no.
How emotional were people about this?
Oh, extremely.
That's Aaliyah Blackburn, a reporter with WTHI, the CBS affiliate in nearby Terre Haute, Indiana. She covered a series of town hall meetings and says each one was packed.
You could tell in the passion in their voices and, you know, the expressions on their faces, their body language, that this is something they deeply care about.
But even though the towns are less than 9 miles apart, with a total of only 750 students, they decided their school districts were stronger apart. This scenario isn't uncommon in Illinois. With 852 districts, some with fewer than 50 students, consolidation comes up and gets voted down a lot, despite the fact that it's got supporters in both political parties. Two different think tanks, the Better Government Association and the Conservative Illinois Policy Institute, have advocated for more districts to consolidate. IPI says consolidation would cut taxes by reducing the number of school superintendents who get high salaries and fat pensions. BGA points to the stability in academic programs that could come from a more robust pool of teachers. So what's the problem? Legend has it that nobody wants to lose their mascot. But plenty of schools co-op sports, like Ambrose's football team, and manage to compromise on the mascot. Money can be a big sticking point if one district has debt or pays their teachers higher wages. And State Senator Chapin Rose, a Republican from Mahomet, suggests it's the math of mileage.
I believe there's a lot of districts out there that want to explore consolidation, but once they find out that their kids are going to be on a bus driving for hours in one direction, just sort of ends the conversation.
He's pitching a plan that would allow any elementary district to dissolve and disperse its students among multiple neighboring districts. Right now, they have to pick just one. His plan got a green light in a preliminary hearing when he told lawmakers about a school he represents.
You have a school district that is having a hell of a time operating with 80 kids K-8. 80 kids K-8.
Another measure, sponsored by State Representative Rita Mayfield, a Democrat from Waukegan, would form a commission to see which districts could save money by consolidating and then give taxpayers the chance to vote. The Senate version of that measure would limit it to so-called non-unit districts, districts that only go up to 8th grade or districts that serve only grades 9 through 12. For now, small districts will continue creatively combining special ed services, sometimes food purchases, and of course, sports teams. Coach Ambrose's team, known as OPH, won more games in its first season than either Palestine, Hudsonville, or Oblong had won in the previous year.
We won 3 games, and I had many guys who'd never won a football game the whole time they've ever played football. They just worked well together.
I'm Dusty Rhodes.
Homeless kids are almost 90% more likely to drop out of school than students with homes. The good news, schools can help those kids if they figure out who they are. Lee Gaines spoke with one student who did get help from her high school.
Melissa Esparza fled her parents' home 2 years ago. She was 16 then. She says her parents were verbally and physically abusive.
One day, my mom and I were having an argument, and it turned into the day that she ended up hitting me, pulling some of my hair out. She punched me, scratched me, had scratches all over me. So I called my boyfriend and I told him to come pick me up. I just couldn't be there anymore.
Esparza went to school the next day. She told her guidance counselor what had happened, and that set in motion a really important process. Esparza was marked as a homeless unaccompanied youth. That's a student who lacks both a permanent stable residence and a guardian or parent. Esparza says her parents haven't contacted her since she left their home. She says she got through this traumatic time with a lot of help from her school.
And my grades did end up slacking a little bit, but once I talked to all my teachers and told them kind of what was going on, they did help me through it, and my grades did end up coming back up.
But Esparza's experience might be the exception, and that's because homeless kids are falling through the cracks.
Imagine what would have happened if she hadn't asked for help. If she hadn't said something?
That's Beth Horowitz. She's with Chapin Hall, a research and policy center at the University of Chicago. Their research shows an estimated 1 in 30 high school age kids experience unaccompanied homelessness. Schools aren't identifying all of those kids, and if they're not identified, they can't get the help and resources they're entitled to under federal law.
Depending on the school system, they are not necessarily motivated to find the students because of the sort of mismatch between their requirement to serve students experiencing homelessness with the amount of funding available to do that work. And so how do we help schools find students better.
Horowitz says there's a program in Australia that's shown good results. They give every student a survey to identify who's experiencing or at risk of experiencing homelessness. And Horowitz says they've seen fewer homeless kids and lower dropout numbers. She says they're planning to pilot that program in schools in the U.S. In the meantime,
every day that we don't intervene with young people is another day where they're development is interrupted and where they're unable to transition to stable adulthood. And that's a problem and is something that we as a country should be focused on.
And it's something Deb Dempsey really wants educators to focus on. She's a homeless school liaison for Kane County, and she's the person schools reach out to when they identify a homeless student. Dempsey invited Esparza to share her story with educators at a recent professional development day in Elgin.
They did it on their own with just a little bit of help from us, which I know you guys are all dealing with students every day as well, and you can see what a difference it makes.
That's Dempsey talking to a group of educators. Esparza says Dempsey was there for her when she had no one else to turn to. She helped her get a medical card, food stamps, and apply for financial aid. Dempsey says a lot of teachers and principals don't understand what kids like Esparza go through.
We're trying to bring it to school personnel's attention that, you know, there are reasons kids aren't living with their families and they still have the right to go to school and they should have an adult working with them.
Esparza says she also wants educators to get better at spotting homeless kids.
And like if you see a change of pattern and like they're showing up like less, their grades are slipping, or they're just not talking as much in school anymore, that something's probably wrong and something's happening at home.
Esparza graduated from high school last year. With help, she overcame homelessness. But until schools get better at identifying homeless youth, success stories like hers may continue to be an exception, not the rule. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Next up, libraries have existed in some form for thousands of years. Yet the commentator Krista Bauer-Sharp says there are still misconceptions about them. So she joins us today to do some library myth-busting.
When I tell someone that I am a librarian, I often hear one of two responses. Oh, I love the smell of books. Or, that must be fun. You get to read books all day. I'd like to take a minute to bust some myths and replace them with facts about libraries, what happens in them, and the important role they play in our society. Myth number one, libraries are only about books. Libraries still value books, but they have also kept abreast of new sources and formats of information. Periodicals and indexes and audio and video recordings are now offered digitally. Public libraries circulate tools and professional clothing for job interviews. College and university libraries host regional archives and digital collections of local works. The main goal towards which most libraries work is the common good, making resources available to many people, including those who could not afford their own copy or subscription. At Western Illinois University, we extend our permanent library collection by hosting materials on reserve for courses and borrowing items through our interlibrary loan service. Myth number two, librarians spend all day reading. Libraries offer a wide variety of resources, but the dynamic center of the library is its staff. Public librarians help entrepreneurs, medical librarians ferret out studies for doctors, and academic librarians teach students how to find, evaluate, and organize information for projects as diverse as freshman papers and doctoral dissertations. Librarians perform many functions that connect users with the resources and services they need. I have never yet met a librarian who sits around all day and reads books. Myth number three, libraries are quiet places and librarians like shushing people. Yes, libraries usually provide quiet space for those wishing to concentrate, but that's not the whole story. If you visit the Malpass Library at WIU, you might hear any or all of the following. A conversation about a class project between a librarian and student at the reference desk. A session of Management 474 or Sociology 323, during which a librarian teaches how to conduct research. Or a computer beep, announcing the arrival of an instant message reference question. The upper floors are quiet space, but lower than that, you can hear the learning, and librarians are just as likely as students to be making noise. Myth number four, libraries are becoming obsolete because everything is available on the internet. In reality, the need for libraries and librarians is stronger since the advent of the internet, because the sheer volume of data overwhelms many. At WIU, we offer hundreds of research tools, some general, some specialized. How does one decide which is the best to use for a project? Librarians are intermediaries, and according to a 2019 American Library Association report, they are busy. In the college and university setting alone, librarians interact with almost 38 million people each year, more than the 4 million people who attend men's college basketball games. Furthermore, the early hope that the internet would make all information freely available has proven false. Today, companies package information and sell temporary access to it for exorbitant prices. Why am I talking about this now, when there are so many other challenges facing us? Because the societal trend towards valuing only what is easily quantifiable means that academic libraries and the institutions of higher education they serve are under attack. The myths I've described are being used against libraries, including WIUs. So, I encourage you to visit and support your local library, public, school, or academic. That wonderful smell of books will not be as important as the wealth of learning, activities, and resources available to you.
Krista Bauer-Sharp is an assistant professor and coordinator of reference services at Western Illinois University. Stay with us, the R. Kelly story, how a superstar has fallen and why some refuse to give up on him. We'll have more on that coming up. You're listening to Statewide. One of the biggest challenges for art museums is conservation of paintings. We'll hear how some Illinois researchers are helping. That story, it's on the way. The co-founder of the Illinois Innocence Project, which has helped exonerate a dozen prisoners since 2001, is calling on the Attorney General to help investigate claims of innocence. Bill Clutter, who helped start the group, says nonprofits are limited in their investigations, and county officials are often unable to independently review cases.
Local legal communities are tight-knit, and you know, prosecutors that have the role of state's attorney tend to protect their predecessors. And even judges to some extent. I mean, it's just human nature.
Clutter is calling for the creation of a statewide conviction integrity unit of lawyers and investigators to look into innocence claims. Cook County's conviction integrity unit cleared 54 felony charges last year.
For Statewide, I'm Daisy Contreras. Artist R. Kelly was in Springfield this past weekend, where he earned $20,000 for a one-hour show to meet with fans. That's according to TMZ and their sources. But his actual show was allegedly no more than a minute. Fans paid up to $100 to see him. R. Kelly took to Instagram to address the media before his appearance.
Yo, this your boy Kells, and I got an event to do tonight in Springfield, Illinois. So I want the media to take it easy on me, man. This is how I got to get paid now for right now. So I got to go do this event, and it's a party. So when you see me in the club with a couple of drinks in my hand and chilling, please, take it easy. Appreciate it, y'all. Thanks.
That was R. Kelly in one of his Instagram videos to fans. R. Kelly has been charged with 10 counts of sexual abuse in Chicago, issues that are not new for the R&B singer. To talk more about these allegations and R. Kelly's financial fallout, I'm joined by Kathy Cheney, deputy managing editor for the Chicago Sun-Times. She has been covering R. Kelly for more than a decade. Before we begin, I did speak to a fan who went to see him at this venue in Springfield. She didn't want to be recorded for radio, but she did tell me she believes R. Kelly hasn't had a fair chance. She said to me, and I quote, "I still support him as an artist, but if he's convicted, that might change." She said she thinks there are different standards for different people, and R. Kelly is being held at a different and unfair standard because he's famous. Kathy, you've had similar reactions from other fans.
Yes, it's no different from all of the other fans who continue to support him, and he's had new fans that have popped up in the wake of the new allegations, in the wake of him being acquitted from the first trial. I don't think he's being held to a different standard. The charges are serious, and even though he was found acquitted the first trial, similar allegations have continued to come up over the years, and now he's been charged again with, you know, 10 counts of even more serious charges along the same line. So, yes, people are innocent until proven guilty, but it would seem like it would give you a little bit of pause because everyone's trying to sift through everything to find out, you know, what's going on. I would be cautioned to completely say I still fully support someone, you know, while they're going through this. Yes, again, innocent until proven guilty, but I would be cautious because of the charges, and they're very similar from the ones that he was acquitted from.
You mentioned that R. Kelly actually gained new fans through the media attention he's been getting after the docuseries Surviving R. Kelly came out. How can we explain this?
I would just say that, you know, in talking with, you know, a few supporters and a few new supporters, it just all stemmed around he was acquitted. Some people who really didn't listen to his music before, but they saw the docuseries, they wanted to go back and, like, listen to some lyrics, and then they just listened to everything that the women were saying. They were listening to what he was saying. They listened to what he said in the Gayle King interview, and they wanted to give him a chance because some people feel like he's being railroaded. So they jumped on board of the R. Kelly train and, you know, are now supporters and are listening to his music, all just for the simple fact that he was acquitted the first time. And, you know, they feel that he's just being made, you know, he's a sacrificial lamb for so many other artists who have supposedly gotten away with, you know, doing similar things and they haven't been on trial and things like that. So, I mean, the fans are, they're relentless.
Going back to R. Kelly's Instagram video, he said this show in Springfield was the only way he can earn money and asked the media, the news media, to take it easy on him. Are these shows examples of his desperation for money? There have been accounts that he has been struggling financially.
Oh, I absolutely believe that. Where else would his money be coming in from? And he said it that, you know, it's hard for him to, you know, book venues, to go on tours, different little things like that. So I do believe that whatever he can try to get is what he's going to try to do. So I wouldn't be surprised if he's popping up in smaller towns, doing smaller venues to get, you know, money because, again, where else is it coming from?
For Statewide, I'm Daisy Contreras, and I'm talking to Kathy Cheney from the Chicago Sun-Times. She has covered R&B singer R. Kelly for over a decade. R. Kelly appeared in Springfield this past weekend, one of his first public appearances after being charged with 10 counts of sexual abuse in Chicago. Kathy, let's talk about the media coverage in Springfield for this event. Do you feel there was a difference in media coverage than, let's say, if R. Kelly had appeared in Chicago?
Absolutely. In Chicago, we're just always on top of it. Everyone's always looking out for, you know, what's going on with him next. Where is he? You know, we have like a leg up on things. Springfield, that's downstate. The media coverage is different. It's more of a political town with political media focusing more on that. So I'm not surprised that it got little coverage. Completely expected the Associated Press to be on top of the story. But again, if you have some fans that are down there, it could have been strategic to make sure that it was, you know, kept a little bit quieter than normal so it wouldn't get as much press attention than it did.
And for those who haven't been really keeping up with the accusations against the singer, Kathy, can you give us a breakdown of what's been happening and any recent developments?
So R. Kelly, right now he's out on bond. So he is not a free man, but he's out on bond. And he is pretty much free to try to make some money, but his efforts have been hampered where, you know, some places, some venues don't want him, some countries don't want him to, you know, come and perform. So he's been having those type of challenges. So he's right now dealing with that. He's dealing with his child support case and trying to get that all together where those court records are sealed. So we really don't know what the deal was made with that and how everything is going. So he's basically trying to I guess, reclaim his life while he's awaiting trial. And his biggest, you know, hurdle is just trying to make some money so he can live.
And this is not new, and we've said this before, this is not new for R. Kelly. He has faced charges in the past. What is different with the current charges that he's facing?
So this is not new for Chicago. We've been here before. As you said, the charges and the first trial, they were centered on child pornography because those were the easiest charges to charge at that time based on the evidence. So this time around, and I know that R. Kelly has said, especially on the Gayle King interview on CBS, that, you know, he was acquitted. Why is he being charged, you know, with the same thing? He's not being charged with the same thing this time around. The first time around, again, there was child pornography charges. This time around, alleged sexual assault, sexual abuse charges. So completely different. And there's more evidence and there are more witnesses and alleged victims that are speaking out. So those are the key differences is that there appears to be more evidence and, you know, more victims coming out to speak versus the first trial.
What do we expect to see in the next few months, in the next few years? Do we think it will take a long time for a trial to take place?
It took years for the first trial to even come to fruition. This time around, I don't think it's going to take years. I can't pinpoint, you know, a time frame because, you know, all the different things with the court motions and things like that. But I definitely feel confident in saying I don't think it's going to take some years, like 6 years, like the first trial. I don't want to say it's going to be a speedy trial where in a few months, you know, they're going to set a trial date or anything. But I do think that the trial will happen much sooner than it did the first time around.
Kathy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Daisy Contreras speaking with Deputy Managing Editor Kathy Cheney of the Chicago Sun-Times. She's covered R. Kelly for more than a decade. Tool from Northwestern University researchers could revolutionize how art museums conserve important paintings as they age. You may not realize it, but paintings go through their own kind of puberty, even developing acne. Kate McGee with member station WBEZ has this report.
When artist Georgia O'Keeffe was painting in the desert of New Mexico, she noticed these pin-sized blisters forming on the surface of her paintings. She assumed they were bits of sand mixing with the paint. But then the bumps started to grow and spread. In some cases, paint started to flake off. This got people worried, including Dale Cronkite, the conservator at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He says, let's say the white bumps are growing on a green surface.
What you end up seeing is a green surface with lots of little white dots, or from a distance, a much different color than what O'Keeffe originally put there.
Now, scientists at Northwestern have diagnosed O'Keeffe's paintings with something they call art acne. It happens when fatty acids in paints mix with the lead and zinc pigments also in the paint. They create these metal soaps that rise to the surface and create a tiny bump. At some point, these little bumps can actually pop, an art conservator's nightmare.
You can look at almost any 20th century painter who's using oil paints, say, prior to 1970, and this exact same phenomena is going to be happening.
Paint manufacturers started mixing paint differently around then, and that paint doesn't develop these protrusions as easily. But that does nothing for older paintings.
The problem of soap protrusions in paintings is one of the most critical problems in conservation. Approximately about 70% of old paintings have soap protrusions on them.
That's Mark Walton, one of the scientists at Northwestern who worked on this project. He runs the university's Center for Scientific Studies in the Arts, a collaboration with the Art Institute of Chicago. But it can be a lot of work to diagnose a painting with this acne. You have to take the painting to a lab to get tested. It involves huge lights and equipment, and moving priceless works of art is expensive. The scientists at Northwestern developed a handheld tool that could change all that. It's a mobile app that can scan art where it hangs using an iPhone or a tablet. Here's Walton again.
You are armed with this data almost immediately, so you can make real decisions. You can go to multiple paintings at the same time to make comparisons, and also you can bring it into locations that you would not normally bring photographic equipment. So it actually changes the entire way we process these sort of data and makes it more accessible and more democratically available.
The app creates 3D images of the painting using technology that can help conservators differentiate between a simple brush stroke and these bumps. That way they can detect issues even if they're not visible to the human eye and correct them earlier. Right now, this acne isn't curable. Conservators can restore paintings, but it can keep coming back. Walton hopes this app can help people better understand how it forms and grows. Maybe this will lead to a cure.
We're probably around 10 years away from really truly understanding how to do that. And this is part of the process of building the information to be able to understand this macroscopic and very complex reactivity that's going on within paint films.
The scientists say they hope to release the app publicly in the next few months. Then conservators from Santa Fe and beyond can use it to measure art acne on their paintings. Kate McGee, WBEZ News.
That wraps up another edition of Statewide. If you missed any of this program or past episodes, they're all available at statewideshow.com. Also, keep up to date with us by following us on Facebook. Look for Statewide Show. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us again at this time next week. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.